This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio, New South Wales.
Good afternoon, it's David Claughton, and on the program, should Q fever vaccinations be available for children and at what cost?
I think that every vaccine, including Q fever, should be available to people who are in need. For example, Q fever for kids on farms, and yes, I think it should be free.
We'll hear from Joanne Bucknell, whose son got Q fever when he was just 4 years old. And Sunday, and public holiday penalty rates will be reduced for hospitality workers from 175% of their standard wage to 150%. Will that be good for you or for your business? Send us a text at the Country Hour on 0467 922 684. 0467 922 684. Your thoughts on penalty rates on Sundays. But first to National Rural News.
We've got plenty of corporate dairy news to get through, and we'll find out why US farmers are becoming increasingly nervous. G'day, I'm Brett Worthington. The Meatworkers Union says today's decision to cut weekend penalty rates for the retail and hospitality workers is a race to the bottom. While the Fair Work Commission's ruling doesn't yet affect meat processors or other rural industries, the union says employers will apply pressure on pay rates. Patricia Fernandez is the secretary of the New South Wales branch of the union.
I think employers now will take this as a positive thing and now say, OK, well, let's have a blanket rule and apply it to all. And instead of, you know, paying people the highest, it's a race to the bottom of the barrel.
It's the end of an era for Australia's oldest dairy processor, with the Canadian-based Saputo securing complete ownership of Warrnambool cheese and butter. Serena Locke has the details for the Country Hour.
Analysts say the book is now closed on a piece of Australian dairy history. Japanese-owned Lion, which held a 10% stake in the Victorian processor, has sold it to the Canadian family company for a higher price, $9.05 per share. Lion had held out until Saputo stepped up its offer. A statement from Lion said it had made a small profit with the sale. Saputo will take a 100% control of the Victorian Processing Company, Australia's oldest dairy, established in 1888, and it will be removed from the Australian Stock Exchange.
Meanwhile, the battle for Tasmanian organic infant formula manufacturer Bellamy's continues. The company will hold an extraordinary meeting on Tuesday as it attempts to fend off a bid to overhaul its board. Tasmanian businesswoman and shareholder Jan Cameron is the driving force behind the board battle. She's called on the corporate regulator ASIC to force Bellamy's to release its half-year results before next week's meeting. Bellamy's board has urged shareholders to reject the changes. Just lastly on dairy, the administrators of the failed milk broker National Dairy Products have put the company into liquidation. It comes after it went into voluntary administration in November. Creditors have rejected an offer to receive between 5 and 17 cents for every dollar they're owed. Gippsland farmer Fiona Plant is owed tens of thousands of dollars.
I'll be trying to find whatever means I can of getting ASIC support to fund litigation proceedings. We've already lost millions of dollars. We can't afford to pay the liquidators to go hunting down Tony's assets.
Former owner Tony Esposito has not responded to a request for an interview. Turning to other news, and concessional loans of up to $130,000 and freight subsidies on fodder will be available for bushfire-affected farmers in New South Wales. The loans will have a 2-year interest-free and repayment-free period. The freight subsidy will go up to half of the cost of transport to get to the burnt-out farms. John Newcomb from the state's Rural Assistance Authority says applications will be determined on a case-by-case basis.
Replacement and repair of damage caused by the fires, and we also cover essential working capital. So that's the amount of money that's required to continue that farming operation until the next major source of income comes in. So it's very dependent on the particular farmer who's applying on what sort of level of funding they may need and what is best for them.
Just briefly, let's head to the US, where there are growing concerns among farmers that they might not have access to their workers as President Donald Trump cracks down on immigration. Illegal immigrants account for up to 70% of farm labour on fruit, veggie and dairy farms in some states. US media have reported farmers in Idaho saying the crackdown could, and I quote, potentially pose a crippling blow to the state's agricultural industry and overall economy. Returning home now, and a South Australian exploration company is optimistic it will be able to commercialise one of the world's largest deposits of a resource used in the steel industry. The CSIRO and Archer Exploration have carried out tests on 300 tonnes of cryptocrystalline magnesite in the state's far north. Archer Executive Chairman Greg English says the next step is talking with processors to get the project underway.
Because it's such a large resource, it's basically infinite, just as long as we can keep mining it economically and we can find customers for the product. There's a growing demand because it's used in the steel industry and the agricultural industries. The steel industry overseas is still going strong, so we're confident that, yeah, that we can find a market for our product.
Okay, let's finish in the Czech Republic, where there's an unusual problem with its wild boar meat, with animals becoming radioactive. A cold and snowy winter has forced the boars to feed on underground mushrooms common in the region. But these mushrooms can absorb high levels of the radioactive isotope that was released in the Chernobyl nuclear catastrophe. The semi-good news, though, is the meat from the radioactive animals, you'd have to consume large doses of it to cause any issues. So go steady next time you're eating Czech wild boar meat. You can read more about that and rural news from right across the country. It's on the Rural homepage right now.
Thanks, Brett. And I don't know that I've ever tasted Czech wild boar meat.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
David Claughton with you this afternoon, and love to have your thoughts on the stories we're running today. 0467 922 684 is our SMS. 0467 922 684. We'll take you to the Dunedoo sale yards. That area affected by fire is seeing a lot of cattle come through there today. And we're also talking penalty rates. Sunday and public holiday penalty rates are being reduced for hospitality, retail and fast food workers. The Fair Work Commission ruled today that hospitality workers will see their pay rates drop from 175% of the standard wage to 150%. And the Boutique Winemakers Association says, this is Judith Kennedy who runs the awards, what will happen is currently winemakers who usually take the weekend off and put staff in won't be able to at that lower rate, and they'll end up having to work themselves. And a manager in a cellar door that I spoke to up in the Hunter says that some cellar doors who currently close will open. So from a purely economic perspective, he thinks that might be a good result for some areas of the industry. On the question of whether it's fair or not, you know, that's a whole other question, he says. And the Meatworkers Union, you would have heard in the news just a short time ago, says that the decision to cut weekend penalty rates is a race to the bottom. It doesn't affect meat processors or other rural industries, the union says, but it will put pressure on pay rates, and retail workers will have their Sunday penalty rates dropped from 200% loading to 150% and casuals to 175%. 0467 922 684. Love to hear from you if you're currently working weekends or you have a business that employs people on weekends and how that will play out for you. First, though, to Q Fever. And Joanne Bucknell's son got Q fever when he was just 4 years old. She wants children to have access to Q fever vaccinations, but that probably won't happen till the results of a trial looking at its impact on children is finalised. She was on a cattle property near Blackall in Queensland several years ago when her son got sick.
When he was about four, he got really sick. So I took him to the Blackall Hospital. And after a day, they flew us with the flying doctor to Brisbane. And we got in there at about 11:30 on the night. And the doctors there wanted to operate on him straight away because they could feel 13 centimetres of a lump on his liver.
So he was really sick?
He was really sick, yeah.
What were his symptoms?
Just a really, really high fever. It was surprising that he hadn't gone into convulsions with his temperature. And just, yeah, really, really hot and really tired.
What were you thinking at that point?
I actually was thinking that maybe he had meningococcal or something like that.
And what did the doctors say?
They just said that they had thought that he had a really aggressive tumour of some sort on his liver.
Yeah.
And that they would have to operate on it straight away.
What happened then?
So they got, just like at the very last second, they got another doctor to come in and observe him. They then decided that they would do a range of tests instead of operating. So we were taxied all over Brisbane to heart specialists, brain specialists, and we were put into an isolation ward right next to cancer children. And so that was quite traumatic because does he have anything like leukemia or something?
Yeah. So what happened then in terms of, you know, treating him, making him better?
Yeah, so that morning they found out, yes, he's got Q fever. Here's the tablets. You can go home now. And we were out of the hospital within a couple of hours with horse tablets that he took twice a day for the next 2 weeks, and he was fine. So
why do you think Denham, your five-year-old or four at the time, got Q fever then? What was he doing?
Well, he worked in cattle yards, so we lived on a property at Tambo, and he was always helping my parents working cattle. And he loved mustering on the tail, of course, chasing them up and then poking the cattle up the race and branding. And he fed calves and he was always in amongst it. So at his height of 80 centimetres or whatever he was, 70 centimetres, he was at the premium height to receive all of the Q fever bacteria that cattle emit, whether they, you know, because through their faeces.
Mm. When he got over it, were there any lasting impacts? Because there are some questions about Q fever and its impact on child development.
Yeah, so this happened 11 years ago, and it would have been for 6 years, around the end of January, beginning of February, he had flu-like symptoms for a couple of weeks. He doesn't anymore, but for that probably 7 years after he had it, He was always this sick, and that really did hinder his education because he got sick within the first week of going to preschool, and so therefore he had a month off, and then being sick at the beginning of every year really did hinder his education, and me being a teacher, I really did notice.
What do you think about this idea that either, you know, kids should, first, that they should be vaccinated for Q fever if they're on farm, and B, that it ought to be subsidised in some way?
Yeah, well, I think that every vaccine, including Q fever, should be available to people who are in need. For example, Q fever for kids on farms. And yes, I think it should be free. I mean, I've taught in remote communities and I've received free vaccines that are available in remote communities because of the situation and the living conditions that I have lived in.
Pretty expensive. It'll cost the government a lot.
Well, I personally think that I should be able to get vaccines because I pay my taxes and work hard.
She sure does. That's Joanne Bucknell, who lives up in Queensland and was out of Blackall at that time, but now lives in Warwick. And her son, Denham, got very sick, but obviously managed to get over it. So the big question now, of course, is whether Q fever vaccinations can even be given to children. There's a trial happening on that now. And the rural doctors are not really supporting that move at this stage because the science isn't really in. And they also may have some other priorities. We'll follow up with them tomorrow on this issue about whether, if it was safe, would they want to see vaccinations for Q fever rolled out for children over other kinds of vaccines. On the Country Hour, it's 17 past 12. Our SMS is 0467 922 684. Text me if you've got some experience with Q fever, particularly amongst children. And you can also talk to us on our Facebook page. Search for the New South Wales Country Hour. To oysters now, and major disease outbreaks over the past decade have contributed to a steady decline in oyster production and the number of oyster farmers. But industry morale is slowly rebuilding with success in breeding disease-resistant oysters and improving oyster quality. And for the first time, farmers are getting access to commercial stock, as Bronwyn Herbert reports.
Veteran grower Tony Troop has been farming oysters for more than 30 years on his lease at Camden Haven on the New South Wales mid-north coast. Like many farmers, just making a consistent income has been a challenge, but his optimistic new stock of genetically superior oysters will help modernise the industry.
Well, the breeding program hopefully will bring the oyster industry up into the 21st century. You know, we've been relying on basically wild stock for the duration of our industry, which is now, you know, 150 years old. I'm hoping the breeding program will really lift our production and reduce our cost rates.
Tony Troop produces about 20,000 dozen Sydney rock oysters each year, as well as oyster spat for other farmers.
I sell, in a good year, 5 or 6 million small oysters.
Has it been a while since a good year?
It has been a while. We've had hatcheries come and go, and now I'm trying to do it myself, and it's been a very steep learning curve. So I think I'm getting there, but not quite there yet.
The young spat used in his hatchery was developed through years of research by the Department of Primary Industries. Scientist Michael Dove says a move away from using wild oyster stock and instead to a family breeding program has allowed research to be accelerated.
Additionally, we can test each family for each trait, and we can also repeat the tests. For example, we can engineer things that we treat younger oysters or spat and actually get the information related to certain diseases a lot earlier, as opposed to having to wait till they're adults and challenging them to the disease, which was the traditional way.
So instead of waiting, what, 2 or 3 years, you can really push that forward?
That's right. And we do that by other means in the program where we breed early. But you're exactly right. It can shave years off before we actually get the data. And with QX, we can get that data 1 year earlier. For condition, we can also get that data 1 year earlier than what we would if we bred through the normal part of the season.
The industry-owned Select Oyster Company is now managing the breeding program and distribution of its hatchery stock. Operations manager Emma Wilkie says it's only become commercial this year.
So the selective breeding program is decades old, and the amount of research that has gone into it is phenomenal. It's a very sophisticated breeding program. It's on par with salmon, wheat, cattle, and now it's commercial. So we're getting the genetics onto the farm. Select Oyster Company is responsible for facilitating the commercialisation of those genetics at the farm.
Despite better stock, there's still perennial challenges with naturally occurring bacteria that can build up in oyster populations. Chantal Genet is a biologist and shellfish consultant hailing from the east coast of Canada who has been working with growers to control Vibrio.
It's not a disease, it's just bacteria that is natural in the wild. So the only thing is to determine how much, and if it's low numbers, well, go around it. But when it's more variable, like we saw there in Camden Haven, you need to have something to control it. So a UV, which is used in the industry, is good to add, and then the water quality becomes more controlled and less variable, so you have success at the end of the day.
Is Vibrio bacteria an issue for oyster farmers in Canada?
It's an issue for anyone in the world in a hatchery, because Vibrio is natural in the wild. In the wild, while larvae can go where there's none, or just a small portion will survive in the wild. So when you bring them in a closed environment, it will bloom in your tanks because it's a closed environment, it's warmer, so it promotes just the growth.
Tony Troop says Chantal's work has made an incredible difference this season.
It's been fantastic. Chantal was here from the start of this run, and I think this run probably would have finished after about the first week if she hadn't been here, just showing me different ways of doing things and doing different tests and finding out where the source of the problems have been coming from.
And when you say the run would have been short-lived, you mean that the tiny little spat were unlikely to have survived unless she was here?
That's right. Yeah, I start the run with something like 100 million oysters and hopefully go to set with, you know, 10% of those or 20% of those. And, they would have been all dead in the first week if she hadn't been here.
How are you feeling about the future of the oyster industry now?
I'm pretty confident it will keep going. I must be an optimist. I've been in the industry now 30 years and I keep thinking it's about to get better. And it still hasn't quite got better yet. But, I'm hopeful. I think if we can get this breeding program really up and going, I think we'll be onto something. And I think the industry will start to really grow.
Oyster farmer Tony Troop from Camden Haven on the New South Wales Mid-North Coast, ending that report from Bronwyn Herbert. And you have to be an optimist, I think, if you work in those kinds of industries. It hasn't been easy, and the fishing inquiry report's due tomorrow, so all those people working in different sectors of the fishing industry will be hanging out for that. We'll report on that hopefully tomorrow if the timing's good. And the other thing, I suppose, if you've ever dropped into an oyster farm where they sell oysters off the dock, that is a magic environment. So, yeah, it might be a struggle from a business perspective from time to time, but what a wonderful working situation. Now, on the penalty rates, we've had lots of texts come through. 0467 922 684 is our SMS number. We'd love to hear from you. Rates will drop now for people working on Sundays. And Damien in Western New South Wales says, once the government accepts that we now live in a 24/7 society and have government facilities and institutions open weekends, that's when the public will accept a lower pay rate on our weekends. Well, you can actually do a lot of government business on the weekend online, I think. I mean, I've been having a crack at it. It's not always easy, and I know that doesn't provide a solution for some where online access is not great. Matt West of Wagga says, will a drop in penalty rates mean cheaper products in the cafe and retail sector? In theory, it should, but the cynic in me sees just bigger profits for those at the top of the food chain. And it's Gillis, I think, is pronunciation for his name or her name, in Wollongong, says, I've been a chef for 30 years, and the things in life that I've missed out on, my kids, for example, are countless. Take penalty rates away? No. If you want to pay, if you don't want to pay people, then work yourself or don't open. And on the queue fever, Valda Tout at Tamworth says she agrees entirely with Joanne Bucknell, who says queue fever vaccine should be on the children's vaccine program. And Graham says it's an intrinsic part of working livestock, just like sunlight. That's queue fever. Should the government subsidise sunscreen as well? Everyone wants a subsidy, and it's a favourite question of ABC Rural. Thanks for that, Graham. Yes, well, we will hear more from the Rural Doctors Association, who are not necessarily supporting Q fever vaccinations on the vaccine list because they think there are other priorities. Perhaps more on that tomorrow. 0467 922 684. And you can also talk to us on our Facebook page if you search for New South Wales Country Hour. WA scientists have developed world-class technology which, when used in greenhouses, could produce crops all year round, and it could be on the market by 2020. Michelle Stanley has more.
The solar glass looks and works like your typical solar panels, but it's clear. Using nanotechnology, the glass cuts out damaging UV and infrared rays, but still lets the good heat through. The damaging rays are then turned into electricity, which runs cooling, heating, and even water desalination. And the good rays still allow for photosynthesis of the plants. And with hopes it will boost crop yields and food security, scientists are celebrating. They're saying this will allow plants to be grown in parts of the world that are typically too hot or dry.
The benefits of the greenhouse is to guarantee the farmer safety and security of product because farming is quite risky. Secondly, the other big thing that's important to me is we believe with a closed environment under good control conditions, we want to get to the point where we can actually reduce the use of pesticides, fungicides, and any other of the chemicals that are used, because at the end of the day, you do swallow them and you do eat them. So we want to produce what I call a real healthy product, basically toxin-free.
Victor Rosenberg is the CEO of Clearview Technologies, the company working with Edith Cowan University in Perth to develop the solar glass. So how does it all work? Professor Kamal Alame is from ECU and he's been leading the research.
We can tailor the glass by controlling the spectral reflectance or transmittance of the glass so that only the wanted radiation can be used for the growth or for the photosynthesis or the growth of the crop, whereas the unwanted radiation we can convert it to electricity where we can save on the energy needed to power the greenhouse, as I said, and then on the water filtration and on the irrigation, the energy needed for this, we can save the greenhouse a lot of money by generating the electricity needed to do that.
As Professor Kamal mentioned, the harvested energy powers the greenhouse, so it's designed to be entirely self-sufficient and not require an external power source.
In a closed environment, you don't need a lot of water. So that means you don't need a lot of energy to filter the water. If you have an underground water, you don't need a lot of cooling and heating because we use these thin film coating to actually block unwanted radiation so that we can save on and the energy used for cooling and heating. So we hope to end up with a self-sustainable greenhouse that doesn't need the power from the grid, and then it can be producing its own energy to produce a maximum or a good crop yield.
So basically, the idea is to be able to produce any type of crop almost anywhere in the world, and to do that all year round.
In Australia, for example, we have sun. We have sunny days, especially in WA, we have sunny days. So we have the energy from the sun. And then if you have underground water, that's all we need to basically produce a crop. And having these solar or photovoltaic windows, you don't need to be dependent on the grid. That means you can have a self-sustainable, and you can implement those greenhouses anywhere you want in Australia, particularly in areas where you have sun and underground water.
But it's not just something for Australia. Victor Rosenberg says they've had a lot of international interest in the product.
We were in Japan around about June or July last year, and one of the companies who wanted to visit us, a major Japanese steel producer, construction, were interested in the technology. We did a full presentation to them, spent a day with them. And in fact, I thought they were interested in the technology for construction and building purposes, but it turned out they were interested really in greenhouses. And since my meeting with them, I have found out that two or three other major Japanese companies are also going down that path of building greenhouses in Singapore and elsewhere.
And it's hardy. It's been trialled as a bus shelter in Victoria, and Mr. Rosenberg believes it should withstand the harsh Australian climate and even our animals. It's even got potential as a construction material for high-rise buildings. But as you could imagine, with 5 years research and a lot of trial and error, it doesn't come cheap.
Michelle Stanley reporting on what's believed to be a world first, clear solar glass technology that can be used for greenhouses and for the generation of electricity, which sounds like a really fabulous idea. Sarah Hawkes here from the newsroom.
Yeah, g'day, David. The Fair Work Commission has ruled that Sunday penalty rates will be reduced for hospitality, retail and fast food workers. The Commission says the cuts would lead to increased services and trading area hours on public holidays and Sundays. Qantas says earnings in its domestic aviation business have been affected by the end of the mining boom. The airline has revealed a 25% fall in its half-year profit to $515 million. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission has launched an investigation into the proposed merger of two coal mining operations in the Illawarra. The ACCC is worried the proposed merger of South 32 and the Metropolitan Mine at Helensburg may substantially lessen competition in the supply of cooking coal to local steelmakers. The Federal Health Minister has announced $500,000 in funding for suicide prevention on the North Coast during a visit to Grafton today. Greg Hunt also announced a new headspace centre for the town. And in sport, the Hungarian government has confirmed Budapest is dropping its bid to host the 2024 Olympic Games. More than 250,000 people signed a petition against the bid.
Thanks very much, Sarah. And we've had some other stuff on the SMS line. 0467 922 684 is the number to call. And one came from someone who hasn't identified themselves, but he says it's time to pay $1 an hour rate across all hours. We should move into this century. However, they say we can afford penalty rates a lot more than we can afford politicians' perks. And Sam at Griffith says penalty rates, he says back shifts, which I think must be sort of back end of the day, late night shifts and weekend work, should always attract penalty rates. Quite often those who have not worked shifts call for penalty rates to be abolished, but people should try shift work prior to commenting on penalty rates. That one from Sam. Let's find out what's happening with the weather. Peter Smierski is at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, David.
How's it looking?
David, not much really to talk about today. A slight chance of showers or afternoon thunderstorms about the Blue Mountains and Illawarra Highlands. Otherwise, most of the state is mostly sunny. Temperatures quite warm, but it's near the average for most of the places in this time of the year. And as we're going further, in a synoptic situation, there is a trough which is now more or less over the central inland parts, and that trough will move to the northeast tomorrow. Near the trough, we probably in a more or less, if we divide state in the northeastern half of the state, we can expect some showers or thunderstorms, chances are not really that great. The highest probably just again near the central coast and ranges.
And so tomorrow, we're expecting much in terms of fire risk tomorrow, whether that will be bad for fires?
Okay. As far as the fire dangers, we can see some very high fire dangers in a southern inland half of the state. But still rating may change this afternoon.
Okay. And the outlook further on?
If the interesting days are Saturday and Sunday. There will be a trough forming off the coast, and this trough is expected to bring a rainfall, in particular to the central parts of the coast and ranges, and if in some places it can be on a heavy side. So we can be talking about like 50 millimeters around the central coast.
That's a bit more than we thought in the last few days.
It's saying this around the parts of the central coast, and that's in particular areas that people who live around that, like Nelson Bay, and that part of the coast is the most vulnerable to this.
And we've been hearing it's particularly dry further north, so much chance of more rain up that way?
David, there is a chance of showers and thunderstorms over the next couple of days, nothing really out of ordinary, so we're not really expecting a significant precipitation.
Anything else of note, Peter?
If, as I mentioned, that's quite interesting near the coast on Saturday.
All right, lovely. Thanks for your help. Peter Smirsky at the Bureau of Meteorology. It's 26 minutes to one on the Country Hour.
The Country Hour.
We're going to take you to the Dunedoo sale in just a moment or two. Our reporter Michael Kavanagh is out there, and they've been selling quite a few of the cattle that were affected by the recent fire. So it'll be interesting to see what's been happening there. But first, there are some issues around pastures in that area. The recovery process is always daunting, and never more so than after a bushfire. Homes get lost and farm sheds, machinery, hundreds of kilometres of fencing destroyed. It's overwhelming, I think, for farmers in that situation. And then there's the worry of re-establishing your pastures. Agriculture consultant Rob Freeban is in the Dunedoo region assisting farmers whose pastures were destroyed by fire. He says the majority of them should re-establish.
I think overall, while a lot of people probably feel maybe their pastures are ruined, we know from previous devastating bushfires that the vast majority should recover. They won't necessarily all recover at the same rate, because the intensity of the fire varies from paddock to paddock, and the amount of ground cover on some paddocks, that will affect how hot it was. You know, after all, native grasses have evolved in this part of the world, and fire was a regular part of it well before Europeans arrived.
When we look at the pastures, and we're getting around to the period where we would hope to do a bit of planting, the lucerne and all of those crops, so it's a matter of reassuring those farmers.
Well, I mean, lucerne, temperate perennials like Phleras, tropical introduced perennials like Premier Digit grass, native grasses, lucerne, even annual legumes, by and large, there'll be reduced seed levels of some of the annual legumes. By and large, history has shown us that they will re-establish okay in the majority of cases. For example, I was talking to a farmer last night who was badly impacted by the Warrumbungle fire. Now, they didn't get rain for about 3 months after that rain, so they were left pretty bare. But when it did break, the tropical grasses were cattle feed within 6 weeks of that rain. Good feed. A follow-up rain for the autumn break, there was plenty of subclovis, ceradella, bicerula, naturalised clovis, and that to come back. So I think people can be reasonably confident that, although it's been devastating, there's reasonable probability that that most pastures are going to come back. There is some provisos. One is that if you had a paddock shut up and it may have had 6 or 7 tonnes per hectare of dry matter in it, it's going to have been a lot hotter fire than one that might have only had 1 or 2 tonnes per hectare of dry matter in it, simply because there's more material there to burn. It's going to be longer burning and it's going to be hotter. But for a lot of paddocks, the heat below about 15 centimetres of soil. From previous fires and research, temperature doesn't go up much more than about 10 degrees C, and then only for a few minutes, Mike.
Communities across New South Wales have been very generous here. They've provided hay for a lot of the producers out that way, of which they're much appreciated. But I guess there's a little precaution here, because you can get some weeds that you don't really want in that region come with the hay.
Well, I guess, Mike, that's a factor, whether it's after a bushfire, after a flood, or just normal trading in hays. I think it is important. You've got vulnerable pastures at the moment, and if some weed seeds of, say, blue heliotrope or St John's wort came in on any donated fodder or purchased fodder, you know, for the next few years, I think farmers just have to take extra special care in these areas for the appearance of weeds that they may not recognise initially. So the main thing is to get new weeds identified and then work on a program if such happens.
For those impacted, it's a matter then of being a little patient here if they can?
Yes, definitely, Mike. And I think sometimes an event like this provides an opportunity to reassess and plan for the future. And I sort of feel it's important to don't rush into anything. Maybe you were thinking about a pasture improvement upgrade program, and this is going to preempt a strategy to develop a long-term strategy, because you can't solve all your problems overnight, solve everything that the fire has devastated overnight. But it is an opportunity to reassess and replan pastures as well as cropping programs for the future.
Agriculture consultant Bob Freebane with Mike Pritchard. On the Country Hour, it's 19 to 1. And at Dunedoo, where they've had fires recently, there's a store cattle sale happening, and our reporter Mike Kavanagh is there. Good afternoon, Mike.
G'day, David.
What are numbers like today?
Around about 1,000, which is more than normal. Normally, Dunedoo, they have it usually around about between 500 and 700, but today, naturally enough, stock that would normally be sold for probably 3, 4, 5 months down the track, because there's just no feed on the places, there's no pasture. So the owners have to get rid of them, and so they've come in today, and the number's up around about 2,000.
And what's the mood like?
It's actually quite buoyant. You talk to people, they're pleased with the prices, and they're buoyant too in the fact that it's been strongly supported. We've seen agents and buyers coming in that normally wouldn't be here, and so that's made... And there's a feeling, well, we've just got to get on with life. There's obviously a worry that you're losing progeny and generations of cattle down the track because they're either been sold off or destroyed either in the fire or in the aftermath. But, for example, the prices have been going quite well and quite strong. Angus Stewart is the principal for Milling Stewart, who's the agent in Dunedoo. Normally runs these sales. He had the prime cattle sale last week and now the store cattle sale. And Angus is with me at the moment. Now, Angus, a hot day. You've been gulping down the water because the bidding's been fairly furious.
It has been, yeah. There's been a lot of support from around, certainly around the area and from places a long way away. It's been quite positive today, anyway.
Now, you say buyers from away as well. Do you think they came in looking, thinking we're going to get a cheaper price, or what was the reaction from them?
No, I don't think so. I think quite a few people have actually rang me and said that, well, if they could lend a bit of support. Some people been in contact with us about adjustment, and if they couldn't take adjustment, they said, well, we might be able to buy a few. So I don't think no one came here really thinking that they could get a steal of the day.
And around about 50% are from fire-affected properties. I was looking at one from out near Castle, it's 14 months old, going for 1,140, and they're about 350 kgs. And then at 310 kgs, 8 months old, around about 1,180 from just down the road between Dunedoo and Castle. The prices, would you have expected those sort of prices?
Well, it's probably it's a great opportunity for someone to buy some cattle that wouldn't normally be sold. Those heifers that made $1,180 were heifers that they weren't classed out. They were just all the calves off his cows. The cows had to go away on adjustment just because he hasn't got any feed, so he's taken the calves off. They've come into town to lighten the load. So they would be heifers that he would normally keep as breeders. So, yeah.
And the weaners, kind of mixed reaction from some people watching. Some thought that naturally enough because they'd literally just been weaned,
yep,
and lower than they expected. And then other people said that they performed quite well for such young cattle. obviously if they held them for a few months more, they would have done better.
Yeah, yeah.
But they had to get rid of them. Were those the sort of prices you did expect?
Yeah, I think it was pretty good. I thought the sale was pretty strong all the way through it. I think that all the vendors should be pretty happy. Obviously, there would be some people that they would have liked to have a little bit more weight in their cattle, but in circumstances, they couldn't allow that. They've got no food at home, so they're only going backwards.
Now, last Wednesday, you weren't going to have a timed cattle sale, and there's such demand. Today, now, we've had the store cattle sale and the regular fortnightly sale. The numbers are around about 1,000. How do you see it, judging and listening to the buyers and the sellers? Is it going to dry up?
I think, our numbers around us will certainly dry up. We've got a big portion of ours that's been burnt out. Quite a lot of the cattle that are in that area, breeders that haven't been affected by the fire, have gone away on adjustment. And now we're sold. A lot of these cattle would be what we'd be selling in 12 months' time. So it'll put a pretty big hole in certainly producers around our area, just because they're selling next year's income, really, isn't it?
The ones that are really going to be hurt would be the local traders that would be normally buying and selling and trading on that market. And as you say, if they've got them adjusted out, they can't put them anywhere else. That'll definitely slow down in the very close area of those looking in that sort of market.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it'll numbers will dry up around here a bit. Like we'll have the season's the king. So if it dries up. And if it stays dry the way it is, we'll still have numbers, but as soon as it rains, we won't have anything.
And then briefly then, given the prices, can you see them just still holding up because of the demand elsewhere as well?
Yeah, it's a bit hard to read at the minute. There's a lot of pressure on the job just through how dry it is and numbers coming forward. But you can see if we could get a break that would slow down those numbers, I think the job would stay pretty good.
David, that's Angus Stewart from Milling Stewart, the agents in Dunedoo, the regular auctioneer at the Dunedoo sale, where today we've seen a lot more cattle for sale and around about 50% of those being from bushfire-affected properties and fairly buoyant and optimistic buying.
Thanks very much, Michael. And any news on cattle that might have been sold as part of raising money for donations? Have you heard anything about that today?
Not bad. Angus might have heard something about that. The selling of cattle for donations to raise money. Have you heard much about that, Angus?
Yeah, there was some cattle, pen of heifers was bought today from Tony Inder at Rockwell and gone over to Alexander Downs Feedlot. And they'll be fed over there, and then the proceeds of those, from what I understand, will go to fire-affected victims.
Brilliant.
So there are people that are still doing those sorts of things as well.
Yeah.
And the fodder is still coming in. And the CWA hall is full of goods. And in fact, they've got a lot of clothing and foodstuffs. It's now really donations of money. And then the infrastructure rebuild with BlazeAid begins in earnest on Monday.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Mr. Kavanagh.
Cheers, David.
Michael's out at the Dunedoo Sale Yards where they've got the store sale on today. And if you're interested in accessing or donating money, then go to our Facebook page, New South Wales Country Hour. Michael's put a picture of the sale yards up there today, but you'll also find links to the Mayor's Fund if you want to donate money to fire-affected farmers, and the CWA, the contact there if you're interested in picking up some clothes and kitchen items and things like that. New South Wales Country Hour is the number to search for. And still on the fires, concessional interest rate loans and freight subsidies will be available to farmers across New South Wales hit by those bushfires in different areas. Director of the state's Rural Assistance Authority, John Newcomb, says the funding will be determined on an individual needs basis with each farmer who applies.
There's a loan available, a loan of up to $130,000, low interest rate over a long term. And in addition, there's freight subsidies of 50% of the cost of transporting fodder to an affected property or stock to and from adjustment.
Now, the $130,000 for those in urgent need, how do they qualify?
So they need to approach the RAA, the Rural Assistance Authority, to get that loan. Now, there's a couple of ways that they can do that. One is to contact us directly, and a good place to start is on our 1800 number and talk to us directly. Additionally, they may like to take advantage of the Rural Financial Counselling Service that's available across New South Wales. That's a free service, and often that service is used to help farmers complete the application form to apply for the loan.
What is urgent need?
We cover under this loan replacement and repair of damage caused by the fires, And we also cover essential working capital. So that's the amount of money that's required to continue that farming operation until the next major source of income comes in. So it's very dependent on the particular farmer who's applying on what sort of level of funding they may need and what is best for them.
Now, this goes for working capital replacement, repair of damage. Now, given a lot of the properties that were damaged by the fire, there's virtually nothing, 130 grand, it's not going to go very far.
Look, it's not a huge amount of money, but it certainly will help farmers in replacing some of the essential items. May need to do some fencing, place some equipment that's been burnt, but at the moment, yes, the $130,000 is the maximum they can receive.
John Newcombe from the Rural Assistance Authority, and the number to call if you want to get in touch with him is 1-800-814-647, 1-800-814-647, and they do have people there that can actually help you fill out the form. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by everything that's going on your property affected by fire, give them a call anyway, because there's no point self-assessing, and they can help you fill out the form. And there are other numbers there as well if you want to access other sorts of support. On our SMS, 0467922684 is our number. And Barry wrote in about the penalty rates issue to say if they take $6 billion out of the economy, its multiplier effect, you know, will have a big impact. It sounds like the government's trying to crash the economy rather than fix things up. And Kate says it's a bit unfair to change penalty rates for some and not others. A person in a cafe will get a lesser rate than the mall cleaner because they're under different awards. And that is difficult, but let us know if that's your situation. 0467 922684 is the SMS number. And you can chat to us on our Facebook page as well. A 10-year plan into the expansion of the nation's energy future is focused heavily on the development of the services and manufacturing sectors. It's timely given the current political debate that's raging over energy security. It was launched at the Australian Oil and Gas Conference in Perth, and Babs McHugh is there.
Miranda Taylor is the CEO of the National Energy Resources Australia Group, NERA. She says the 10-year energy plan has the greater adoption of technology at the top of its agenda.
It's trying to operate and drive the competitiveness of the assets that we've got, but it's also trying to build Australian small businesses that are operating in the energy resources sector, and actually being able to lift them to be able to compete on a global market.
Australia is a very high-cost jurisdiction in the oil and gas space. Miranda Taylor says to overcome that, small and medium enterprises, SMEs and supply chains need the ability to work closer with the big energy companies.
Basically, the supply chain know what the problems are, but the operators own the data. And we've got big cost challenges and we've really got to drive down costs. But we also want to find new value. So we want to release and create new value in the Australian economy. And we really want to build an ecosystem of SME companies that are able to work on the problems and technologies that we need to drive some of the areas of efficiency. And instead of, for instance, a Chevron or a Woodside going to the open market to buy a urgent piece of maintenance equipment that they need, they could actually go to their neighbour and actually buy that product much more quickly and much more point at source, and probably drive down costs by overall by 25%.
Isn't that one of the big difficulties, though, with the service industries, the small and medium enterprise, and the whole way along the supply chain, that they've been left out to a large extent, and the deals are being done with cheaper overseas companies? They'd need to be guaranteed income and return.
So I think we're really talking about a completely different business model. So in a sense, if you like, you've got technology and solutions in search of problems, and then problems which haven't necessarily been well articulated. It's been quite prescriptive and controlling. And in this world that we live in today of really explosive technological development, we actually have to change our way of engaging with the supply chain into a partnership model.
There's been $200 billion spent on the Australian natural gas industry in the last decade. With the sector switching to a production phase now, Ms Taylor says the timing is right to expand the service and manufacturing businesses.
We've just come out of a massive phase of capital investment and construction and commissioning. And for various reasons, Australia has become a high-cost destination. We've got lots of competitive advantages and strengths, though. Our proximity to Asia, our highly skilled workforce. We've got very good research, very good ideas. We're very good at generating innovation at source. What we're not very good at is commercialising it. If you think of the manufacturing industry and where they've been, where they've been forced to change because of the pace of disruption around automation and 3D printing and the Internet of All Things, we absolutely need and want to embrace the advanced manufacturing world and the digital world. In fact, we have to, because otherwise we'll be left behind. The productivity will come from really being able to work much more efficiently by deploying those sorts of technologies into our industry. So the time is absolutely right for us to grapple the productivity story.
The oil-rich country of Norway is often cited as an example for Australia's energy industry to follow. Ms Taylor says in developing the strategy, NERA definitely took a leaf out of Norway's book on collaboration.
The explosive change in digital technology actually creates, for the first time, the ability for Australian industry to easily be able to participate in a global market, because we're no longer reliant on just geographic location. We've got online engagement, we've got marketplaces which are online marketplaces, they're platform marketplaces. So suddenly the ability for Australia to actually leverage from that and actually really commercialise value, strengthen the links between the research sector and, for instance, SME and technology companies is really huge. And one of the things that we're looking at is a thing called a cluster model. Norway's done this really well.
And that report from Babs McHugh from the energy conference happening in Perth at the moment. Miranda Taylor is the CEO of the National Energy Resources Australia group called NERA. And on the Country Hour now, it's 4 minutes to one. Markets shortly. Bega Cheese had a pretty good result yesterday, $17.5 million in profit for the half year. And that had quite an impact on their share market as well. They went up 4%. And the dairy processor believes it'll be able to capitalise on the recovery in the global dairy market while also manufacturing Vegemite and some other spreads. At this stage, it's unclear how the company will pay for the $460 million Vegemite deal, but that obviously wasn't troubling investors yesterday. Let's go to the Wagga sheep sale. Leanne Dax is there.
Good afternoon. Numbers jumped up to 38,000 lambs and 7,000 sheep. Quality slipped to the previous market, with longer wool lambs showing the effects of the heat. On the back of last week's higher prices, the market lacked the intensity, slipping back $12 to $20. Buyers were selective across trade weight categories, only paying premium prices for recently shorn trade lambs. Light trade 116 to 133, medium trade 138 to 157, heavy trade 146 to 168, averaging 623 cents a kilogram carcass weight, heavy lambs 150 to 179, extra heavies 170 to 224, averaging 630 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Reno trades 121 to 160, store lambs $97 to 130. With the sheep yet to be sold, I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. And we're having trouble picking up our other market reports at the moment. If they come through, I'll bring them to you. And in other news, you might have heard earlier that Lion, the beverage company, has sold its stake in WCP to Saputo, which ends something of an era in the dairy industry. The Canadian-born Saputo will take over 100% of Warrnambool cheese and butter. Lion sold its stake. It's Australia's oldest dairy, established in 1888. And analysts say the book is now closed on a piece of Australian daring history because the company will now be removed from the Australian Stock Exchange. Japanese-owned Lion, which took a 10% stake in the Victorian processor when Saputo acquired almost 90% back in 2015, has sold it to the Canadian company for $9.05 a share. And in January, Lion was offered $8.85, but it held out until it could get a better offer from the Canadian company. A statement from Lion said it had made a small profit with the sale and it wouldn't affect existing contracts such as Parmesan cheese supplies to WCB. And Lion said the company had held the stake as a strategic move. And It was intended to protect the business's broader interests, including long-standing contract arrangements. That's pretty much the Country Hour for today. Apologies, we are not able to bring you those markets from Armidale. And, oh, here we go. Maybe we got one here from the sale which David Monk is attending at Dubbo.
Good afternoon. Numbers are up by almost 600 for a yarding of 3,770. It was a fair to good quality yarding with a good selection of prime cattle in all sections, along with a reasonable selection to suit the feeders and restockers. Not all the regular buyers were in attendance with the absence of some major feeder orders. Young cattle of the trade were up to 20 cents cheaper, with veal selling to 324. Prime steer yearling sold from 290 to 317, while a prime heifer yearling sold to 320. Feeder steers were up to 25 cents cheaper, while the feeder heifers were 14 cents easier. The feeder steers sold from 289 to 338, while the feeder heifers sold from 271 to 312. Ground steers were 5 cents cheaper, with the prime, medium and heavyweights selling from 260 to 305. Ground heifers were up to 12 cents cheaper, selling to 297. Cows were 2 to 4 cents cheaper, with the two scores selling from 160 to 214, while the better 3 and 4 scores sold from 198 to 238, with the prime heavyweights averaging 227. Bulls sold to 265. This is David Monk in Dubbo for MLA.